What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm the excellent Adam Kempinar. Okay, we got a new feature on Film Spotting this week, which allows us to travel through time and space. It's called Chroma Key, and it's really handy if you want to go to New York. Hey, we're in New York.
I got a gun. Let's go to a Broadway show.
Or imagine being able to be magically whisked away to Delaware. Hi, I'm in Delaware.
Party on, Adam.
Party on, Josh. Man, that was ugly.
This week on Film Spotting, we take a cue from our basement-dwelling brethren, Wayne and Garth, and travel through time and space to our top five movies with places in their names.
Excuse me? I baking powder?
Yes, after almost 9 years, it seems we've officially run out of top five ideas. Plus our review of Alexander Payne's latest, Nebraska. That and more.
A sphincter says what?
What?
Exactly.
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store.
For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM11. And stay tuned later in the show when we announce the three winners of our recent Squarespace promotion. You're listening to Film Spotting. Have we, in fact, depleted our supply of top five themes? Well, not just yet. Later in the show, we're going to count down our top five movies with places in their titles. We definitely do have the most cumbersome title award for this week's top five. These are movies with cities, states, countries, whatever it might be in their titles. And hey, it's not like we're doing, I don't know, Josh, movies with bicycles or top five movie redheads, right?
Actually, you know, we've already done both of those.
Of course we have. Well, then this week is just another sign of the end times, because if we're going to get the treasure of Sierra Madre, well, then we got to escape from New York and take the 310 to Yuma. Of course, Josh, you'll be stuck in Cedar Rapids.
I do love Cedar Rapids. But first, can you go home again and again and again? We'll find out as we review Alexander Payne's latest film set in his home state, Nebraska.
So you told the sheriff that you were walking to Nebraska.
That's right. To get my $1 million.
This is Woody Grant.
We are now authorized to pay $1 million to Woodrow T. Grant of Billings, Montana.
This is his son.
You didn't win anything. It's a complete scam. So you gotta stop this, okay?
I'm running out of time.
This is his wife.
I never knew the son of a bitch even wanted to be a millionaire. He should have thought about that years ago and worked for it.
How much longer is he gonna be around? What's the harm in letting him have his little fantasy for just a couple more days?
This is his family.
Woody, here's the talk of the town. Why didn't you tell us you was rich, Woody?
David said not to.
You got it on you. Yeah, we sure would like to see what $1 million looks like.
And this is the problem.
God damn, Woody Grant's a millionaire. That crown is on Woody.
A bit later in the show here, Josh, we're going to get to the results of our poll question from last show, where we asked listeners simply, what's your favorite Alexander Payne film? That wasn't our first obvious choice for a poll question, as he usually does. Our producer, Sam Van Halgren, threw out a couple Payne-related ideas for the poll, and I joked that I was a little surprised one of the options wasn't, does Alexander Payne hate all of his characters, yes or no? Because the C word, condescension, probably comes up in relation to Payne in his films more than any other director I can think of. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, it's a common complaint.
Critics and viewers do seem to complain sometimes that it's almost like he offers up characters only so they can be fodder for ridicule. They're often pathetic figures who we as viewers get to sit in the audience and feel a little bit superior to. For the record, I'm usually the one arguing against that view of Payne in his films, even as I don't put Payne on a high pedestal as a director. It's largely, I think, a matter of tone with Payne and how viewers respond in particular to his style of humor. You mentioned to me, Josh, off-air, that you rarely ever get a firm grasp on how you feel about the tone of Payne's work without some reflection. Unfortunately, you haven't had any time to reflect because we just walked out of the theater after seeing this movie. So I guess I'm going to ask you, what's your gut reaction to Payne's portrayal of Bruce Dern's Woody Grant? an elderly man showing some signs of Alzheimer's who is determined to trek from his home in Billings, Montana, to Lincoln, Nebraska, to claim his $1 million sweepstakes prize. And to his son Davey, played by SNL alum Will Forte, who decides against his better judgment to drive him to Lincoln, really because he had to get out of Billings to do something, anything, before wasting his life away and maybe spending some quality time with the dad who he never had a strong relationship with. Is pain patronizing or sensitive? Is he crude or sentimental? And if some combination of all those, do those contrasts pay off in satisfying ways?
I think he does right by Woody, for sure, the Bruce Dern character. I mean, no doubt. At first, you wonder, I mean, it's a good question because you do wonder, is he just going to be the goofy old guy, you know, who's going to provide some laughs? But it goes much, much deeper than that. And pain is almost too good, I'd say, to Davey. We can talk a little bit about what we think of that character, and maybe it's Will Forte's performance that makes me say that more than how he's directed. But yeah, my instinct is I really like this movie. That's where I feel I want to go with it. But as you mentioned, I don't trust my instinct when it comes to pain films because they are so dependent on tone, which means it's even more dependent on your mood than the average movie. Mm-hmm. Because whatever mood you're in, a tone can strike you completely differently. And that's why I've watched his films on multiple times and come away with completely different reactions to them. So right now, Nebraska, I would rank up there as one of his better films. Not that it was – I mean, it's a pretty rough go. I found it to be very depressing.
Yeah. The black and white is really gritty and grimy, and it paints an unpleasant picture of all of these locales and these people.
The first thing we see is a chain link fence, concrete street, fluorescent LED sign, and muddy snow. You know, mm-hmm. And the cinematography is beautiful. There are also these really picturesque farmland shots and even some downtown shots of an abandoned rural town that are like still photographs. And so it's bleak but beautiful at times too, but it does add to this overall sense of depression. There's references to economic depression and just this story of dealing with an aging parent,
yeah,
who may or may not. One of the things that's not clear here, at least it wasn't to me, and I think this is a good quality, is how much, if at all, Woody is suffering from some sort of dementia or Alzheimer's.
It's not clear at all.
But what is clear is the pain that that causes for the family and especially Davey. And the reason I say that pain is almost too good to Davey is I sensed here, this is a guy who's always trying to do the right thing. And a little bit I wonder, especially the more we learn about this family and the extended family, where did Davey come from? Because everyone else, at least from what we see, appears to be selfish, cruel, vindictive. And then here comes Davey, who's always giving his father the benefit of the doubt. I mean, he's the one who initiates this trip. And it did remind me of the George Clooney performance in The Descendants, in that that was one of the most uninteresting pain characters to me, because he just kept doing the right thing and bad things kept happening to him. And it wasn't even really that comic. There wasn't any tension there to the Clooney character. Mm-hmm. And here, something similar is going on. I think the character works better, but he's a little bit apart from everyone else in his goodness.
Yeah, that's something I'd have to think about a little bit more, because I think you raise an interesting point about his character. Is he, the Will Forte character, dramatically interesting as a character, because he does seem to be so naturally good? At the same time, I think there's something authentic and accurate about that, especially coming from a father who is an alcoholic. I think in that case, I think that's something you see in a lot of families where there was an alcoholic parent. You have one child, at least, who is always trying to keep the peace and be good and is always looking for some kind of silver lining. And so there was something about it that felt right to me, actually, in the way I saw his character, in the way I saw him very different than his brother, played by Bob Odenkirk. Mm-hmm. I think he's really good. And also his mom, who I think we'll have to talk about the mom and her portrayal here at some point here in a minute. I think separate from how I feel about the film, and I'm mostly with you, I think I really like this film as well. And I think I need to let it sit with me a little bit longer, but that is where I'm at. If you wanted to sum up that pain dilemma of how he presents his characters and how we think we're supposed to feel about them, how they make us feel as viewers, I would put almost as a litmus test in this movie, and it's a throwaway moment, but nevertheless, it's something that stood out to me, is a scene where they're at a restaurant and there's karaoke going on. And this isn't a moment that got necessarily a huge laugh out of our theater even, but a couple people I did notice react to it. when the scene starts and our characters come in, or the camera first focuses in on this karaoke scene, there's a woman singing karaoke who, let's just say, she's overweight. She's really shabbily dressed. She's got a haircut that looks like it came from a Poison concert in 1987. And she can't sing at all. So she's got everything going against her. She's not particularly attractive in any way, shape, or form. And she's up there, and Payne does take a moment to let us kind of linger on that sight and her singing. And I wonder if that right there is one of those cases where, as a viewer, you either see that and say, well, why is he doing that? You know, why does he have to present her? I don't care if there are really people like that in small town Nebraska or not. That feels like such a caricature, and it feels like piling on, and it feels like we're just there to sort of mock her and laugh at her. That's one way to look at it. The other way is kind of the way I see it, where I get that reaction, but it doesn't make me laugh at her. I don't watch that scene and scoff at her. And I feel like the people who are scoffing, who blame it on Payne, I feel like it reflects more their attitude. The fact that you're scoffing at her says something about your personality. Maybe you don't want it to, but that's always how I've kind of felt. Just because she's put up there that way doesn't necessarily mean the director wants you to feel that way about her. He's just giving it to you, and you're reacting a certain way to it. But it's a tough issue, and I think that scene is one that really stood out for me.
Yeah, it does work as a litmus test, and I read it the same way you did. I didn't see it as a mockery at all, but the first moment she came into the frame, I was wondering if that's how I was going to read it or how it was going to go, because it does feel like one of those Payne moments. And I would actually put more weight than you on the fact that you would see someone like that in a Midwestern karaoke bar or restaurant or something like that. I mean, we live in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. I've been in places like that. And there's an authenticity to Nebraska from my own experience that is perhaps the reason why I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, is because I do feel at a very deep level he's capturing what is there and not mocking it. I think a point of comparison might be what the Coen brothers did with Fargo,
right,
which, of course, was based partly on their experiences in their youth in that area of the country. So I do think there's some authenticity there. And I also think there's another scene that works as a litmus test. It's when the extended family, the extended Grant family, has gathered to watch football on Sunday afternoon. And this is
like
supposed
nine
to be
men in a living
men.
Room.
This is supposed to be a reunion. A lot of these brothers have not seen each other, we understand, for years. They're all in this room. The camera is from the perspective looking out from the TV where the football game is on, and they are just sitting there in silence as the sports goes on, unless someone brings up a car.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, I wouldn't say what erupts is a conversation, but a few light exchanges are made, and then they go back to watching the game. For me, I've been in those rooms, and I didn't take it as any sort of condemnation of that sort of interaction. It was perhaps tied to a critique of how we communicate and how families communicate. And in that way, I appreciate it and how it tied into the movies, one of the movies' larger themes. So it wasn't there to make fun of these men or this family or how someone's group in a small town might act. For me, it just emphasized, think about the one of the first times we meet Davey, the Will Forte character. He works at an electronics store. And we see him in one of those sealed off rooms where customers will go in to test out speakers. He's talking to a couple, some customers, and we're outside of that room, so we see his mouth moving, but we can't hear what he says. It's just a little touch that reemphasizes what we see throughout this film, is how this is a miscommunication is just rampant throughout this film. And a lot of times it's because people don't even take that first step to try to connect. And so that scene in the living room, I feel it has more to do with that than trying to elicit a laugh at those characters' expense.
Come on, let me take you home.
Going to Lincoln. It's the last thing I do. I don't care what your people think.
Listen to me. You didn't win anything. It's a complete scam. So you got to stop this, okay?
I'm running out of time.
You didn't even have a suitcase.
I'm not staying there.
Dad, I can't let you go.
It's none of your business.
Yes, it is. I'm your son.
Well, then why don't you take me?
You can't just drop everything and drive to Lincoln, Nebraska.
Oh, what else you got going on?
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film from director Alexander Payne. It stars Bruce Dern. It's called Nebraska. I think that's a great observation about communication. And I think also what you see throughout this movie is characters constantly making the mistake of assuming that what they have always known to be true, must be true, about these people, and just kind of going with that gut instinct and not really allowing themselves to have their worldview changed in any way. And so they are prejudging in a lot of cases. And I think that's one of the problems with some of those conflicts that arise. And I'm with you in terms of that authenticity. And I'll say that at the risk of sounding condescending myself, but maybe I'm going to go back to my small town Iowa upbringing, having been in some establishments like the ones we see in Nebraska. And frankly, being at family gatherings that felt a lot like some of those family gatherings that you described there, watching football. And we have Thanksgiving coming up here. And I think back to those Thanksgivings, and I was thinking back to some of those dinners as I was watching this movie. And one of the things I really responded to in this movie, Josh, was just seeing some of those close-ups of those faces, and not only seeing Bruce Dern, that aged, grizzled face and all those wrinkles, but the other characters, some of those characters who I don't know if they're non-professional actors or not, but I've never seen them in any other movies. And being able to just see some of those faces that feel like, quote unquote, real people, with those lines and the tiredness and that sadness, seeing that on a big screen, there's something refreshing about that.
And maybe it's not even that they're quote unquote real people. They're just interesting faces.
Exactly.
This is another thing in
That's
common
it.
With the Coens, is that Payne and his casting directors know how to get the most fascinating face for the smallest part. There's a lot of that here.
Yeah. And I think that those lines and those wrinkles and just that sense of mortality that really hangs over every frame of this film, and being somebody who his favorite pastime is thinking about death, is maybe why I enjoy Woody Allen movies so much, because his characters are a lot like that too. That did appeal to me in this movie. And as I said, I've got Midwestern family members who are like some of those characters, and had a father who was a baby boomer, so would have been an older child of one of these characters who fought in Korea, but still was one of those kids raised by a generation of men like the Bruce Dern character. And there's remnants of that and how they raised us, of course, because that's how they were raised. Men who felt like the Woody Grant character does here. And he says at one point, I serve my country. I paid my taxes. I can do whatever I want. He can do with his body whatever he wants. He can say whatever he wants. He can regard other people however he wants. And that really was sort of a sense of entitlement that he thought he was equipped with, that he had earned that. And that is something that I did feel that connection to. That was more authenticity that I responded to. But I really think you're right in that what it all comes down to is not just the performance of Bruce Dern, which is a real standout of this film. And if I'm not mistaken, he won the Best Actor prize at the Cannes Film Festival for This Turn in Nebraska. I'm not surprised now, having seen it. But I think you have to give Payne credit as well, because as much as there may be a fair amount of laughing at the expense of some characters in this movie, he never laughs at Woody. In fact, the toughest judgment is reserved in this movie for those who scoff at Woody. I don't think Payne ever condescends to him, but at the same time, he doesn't go out of his way to ever glorify him either. And he doesn't just try to make him, you touched on this, he never goes out of his way, as I feared he might, to make him this goofy kind of grizzled relic who we can laugh with, if not always laugh at. Both would have been wrong.
He's not a codger.
No, he's really not a codger.
That would have been bad.
He feels like a fully realized individual. And I love that he doesn't make that mistake. There's real pain. There's real sadness. There's real desire behind Dern's eyes and every expression. And not one line is played for an effect. He's never doing anything to produce an obvious kind of reaction in the audience. He really is just living this character. That's the sense I got watching it on screen.
Yeah, he's really taking a risk somewhat in that he doesn't go for anything big at all here. And it's so affecting that way. There's a vacancy in his eyes in a lot of the scenes that's just heartbreaking.
It is.
And Woody spends a lot of time, you're never quite sure, again, whether he's pretending not to be listening because he just wants a break from all the family squabbling, or because
he's really
out of it. And Dern plays that really well. And the movie, it's a tricky character, because we get characterizations of Woody from other people that are completely conflicting. The brothers talk about how he never cared for us, and his wife, who we should get to next, goes on and on and on about he was an alcoholic and her whole life has been miserable with him. So at the beginning, we think, wow, this guy, really a terrible father and husband. And then when we get back to his hometown in Nebraska, we start hearing stories from those who knew him when he was young, and we get this story of a guy who was always so nice that people took advantage of him throughout his life. Now, how do we hold those two together?
together in tension. Well, you know where you find it? In Dern's performance,
right?
Which is really amazing. So what did you make of June Squibb as Cate Grant, his wife, and Will Forte's character's mother?
Well, here's a case where I give all the credit in the world to June Squibb, the actress, who I don't recall ever seeing in a movie. And I love
she almost
boldness.
Takes it over, doesn't she?
She does. I love the boldness and the brashness of that character. I don't mind the fact that she's clearly there for some comedic relief, and I think those lighter moments work pretty well. But it might be one where Payne pushes it a little too far with her. And look, as positive as I'm being about this film, it's a case where if you were sitting across from me right now just beating this film to death, saying you hated it and felt the whole thing was patronizing, in fact, and was falsely sentimental and hokey, I wouldn't really be able to argue with you. Honestly, I get that reaction from anyone who watches it, because I feel like it's hard to argue in favor of a movie that has scenes and has characters like the Bart and Cole characters, who are, I think that's their names, Bart and Cole, who are cousins of Davey,
twins.
Who, you know, right when you meet them, the way they're sitting on the couch with the goofy grins on their face, it feels like, okay, we're definitely supposed to be laughing at those characters. And I don't know how I feel about that. But then also the mother, she's a spitfire. And I love the energy she brings to every scene she's in. But then we also get this scene at a cemetery, and that, talk about scenes of authenticity. Look, I've spent some time recently at small town cemeteries like that with family members who we stand there and look at the different tombstones, and we get the history lesson
right.
of the relationships and what those people were really like. I've done that a lot lately, and that felt so real. And then you have to, unfortunately, punctuate it with a really kind of crude, vulgar moment that the mom displays that feels like just overkill.
There are a lot
of
swearing grandma moments.
Yeah, exactly. That's where he goes too far with her, where it's like, okay, I'm going to have some fun with this old codger character.
She's
going to be, she's going to be like the rapping grandma, only she's the lewd sexual grandma. And she does a lewd act at one point that just feels like it comes out of nowhere. And you really wish that Payne had some restraint.
That cemetery scene for me is a real missed opportunity, because it could be the moment where we see at least a hint of another side to the mother character. But instead, she just goes from gravestone to gravestone and says something awful and crude about everyone, which is fine because that's been her character up to that point. But maybe we could have gotten one other element of her, and instead she goes for that vulgar joke. Now, the problem here is that I'm actually okay with the twins being comic relief, because they're very supporting parts. It's very broad. You're clear. That's what they're there for, and I think it works in painting the picture of this larger family.
And some of the jokes work. They go back to this recurring joke.
Very good.
That I get. Yeah. Uh-huh.
But the mother, Squibb's character, again, is a much bigger part of this movie, and she just hits the same note every time.
She does. That said, I think there are some other moments, including, I guess you could call it her redemption scene. It's almost a redemption scene more for Woody, where she talks about him, where there's a confrontation with the family that you finally get, even though she's still being kind of belligerent. I still feel like you see a side in her that up to this point, she has never really said anything to defend her husband. And I'm glad that we finally got those moments without it feeling falsely sentimental.
Yeah, that
hokey.
One for me still felt like she was just lashing out at them for herself than for him.
Hmm. Nebraska is out in limited release. It opened here in Chicago this weekend. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. You have to leave it in your best Midwestern accent. You can also find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
What does that Midwestern accent sound like? I have no
you know
idea.
What? It's generic and nobody can imitate it. That's what I love about the Midwestern accent.
Do Film Spotting listeners think Alexander Payne peaked early, or that he's just hitting his stride? The results of the Film Spotting poll are next. Plus, we'll close out our Korean auteurs marathon with a review of A Tale of Two Sisters. Stay with us.
I was falling all the way in. Bind irresistible full moon. Thought I'd never ever be seen again. Found myself lost up until noon. Then I was relieved from the desert scorch. Picked up by a pick-em-up truck. way off course. I never had me a more beautiful day. Can't believe my luck. Can't believe my luck.
I was tossed out into the sea.
We want to jump in here quickly to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM11.
And we do have a great promotional opportunity here for many of our listeners who use the Squarespace platform. We've highlighted a lot of your sites over the past year or so. As we've had this partnership with Squarespace, we're going to get to some winners here in a moment. And you've got a chance to be a winner. All you have to do is send a tweet with a link to your new or existing Squarespace website to hashtag Film Squarespace. So hashtag all one word Film Squarespace, and we'll take a look at your site. Three Squarespace sites will be chosen randomly to get 3 months free to your Squarespace subscription. That's a $30 value. You also get a Squarespace t-shirt, and you will get that mentioned in a future Film Spotting episode. All you have to do, again, send us a tweet with a link to your Squarespace website. Use that hashtag Film Squarespace.
And we do want to give a quick shout out to that first round of sweepstakes winners. They would be Joe Valero. His website is jvalero.squarespace.com. Also, congratulations to Chris DeSanti. You can find him at desantproductions.com. And lastly, Megan Riley, meganrileydesign.com. We will link to each of those sites in the show notes.
I think I've been on Megan's website before. She's a longtime listener and has entered Massacre Theater many times, sent us feedback. I look forward to checking out Joe and Chris's sites. Of course, Squarespace is constantly improving their platform with new features and new designs and even better support, which is already pretty incredible because it's there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Their plans start at just $8 a month and do include a free domain name if you sign up for 1 year. And one of the features that I know a lot of our listeners enjoy is that every design automatically includes that mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website. So your content is always going to look the way you want it to look on every device.
You can start a trial without a credit card. Just begin building your own website. And when you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code FILM11 so that you'll get 10% off and to show your support for Film Spotting. Don't forget, send a tweet with a link to your Squarespace website to hashtag Film Squarespace. That's hashtag Film Squarespace, and we'll check it out. Squarespace has everything you need to create an exceptional website.
If you would like to see your daughter alive again, answer two questions. One, why did I imprison you for 20 years? And two, why did I let you go?
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That was Charlotte Copley of District 9 and Elysium fame as the mysterious Adrian Price in Spike Lee's soon-to-open remake of Old Boy, the original Old Boy, a 2003 film from Korean director Park Chan-wook that is admired by one Film Spotting host, though not by both.
I can't believe you don't like Old Boy, Adam.
How dare you? It's our plan to review Spike Lee's remake when we return from Thanksgiving break in a couple of weeks. This week's poll question, though, is an attempt to gauge your interest in Lee's film, and our interest for that matter. That's coming up in a bit. Right now, though, it's time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this scene.
Hey, you see that Access Hollywood piece?
Yeah, I did.
It was like pistol whipping a blind kid. I mean, I'm not going to sugarcoat it, Tug.
You are a huge star. All right, but right now, you're like that kid on the playground, you know, the one who has lice that none of the other kids want to play with.
What do you mean?
I mean, we gotta shave your head and get you back on the monkey bars, right?
What?
How'd the crying scene go?
Horrible. Lazarus started crying. I mean, he starts drooling and dribbling, and he wasn't even in the
script. Hey, stop right there.
That was Ben Stiller as Tug Speedman and Matthew McConaughey as Rick Peck in Tropic Thunder from 2008, written by Ben Stiller along with Justin Theroux and Ethan Coen. also directed by Stiller.
We got this from Josh Glover in West Fargo, North Dakota. He really did his homework this week with the tie-ins, as we did share last week on the show, our top five actor transformations. Josh writes, there, of course, was Tom Cruise's physical transformation in that film, mostly with makeup. Robert Downey Jr.'s transformation, of course, that was mostly with makeup as well. Ben Stiller's transformation into a Stallone-esque beefcake, Tug Speedman. McConaughey's role in the movie as Tug's agent, and McConaughey was the star of the movie that inspired our top five last week, Dallas Buyers Club. And finally, Steve Coogan was mentioned on the show, and he plays the director in Tropic Thunder. But wait, Josh, there's even more.
The one tie-in, this is a brilliant tie-in that Josh spotted, says the very scene done for Massacre Theater features an advertisement of Simple Jack, the terrible movie depicted in the film, and it shows the titular character chasing a, yes, butterfly. Tying into your anti-butterfly rant, Adam.
I like Tropic Thunder, so I guess there you go.
There's
a film that does work.
A butterfly movie you like. Man, Josh Russell put this under the Zapruder study, going through frame by frame.
I'm going to grab that JPEG. We're going to post it in the show notes if you want to take a look at it. You can see the butterfly in question in that scene from Tropic Thunder. Thank you for that, Josh. If you want to hear our rendition of that scene, plus our review of Dallas Buyers Club and those top five actor transformations, you can get the show at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. Josh, why don't you reach in to the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner?
The winner is Nate Downey from Eureka, California.
Congratulations, Nate. Email feedback at filmspotting.net for your free six-month subscription to Fandor.com.
What do I know? I'm lucky to get the part. I know that. I come from Chicago. We do things a little differently out there. We do the play as written. That doesn't go over in New York. Terrific.
Can't wait to see what listeners find in the background of this scene for Massacre Theater. It is presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information is at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners do get the first 30 days free.
Well, the tie-in this week, the big tie-in anyway, it does connect to our top five movies with a place in their name. So there is a place in the title of this film, and that's all we're going to give you. I don't know that our performances are really going to help this week because we didn't have a chance to check out the scene. We're really going blind here. We're trying to imbue these performances with whatever we're bringing to the table tonight, Josh.
This is going to require improvisation.
That's right. We're not
terrifying.
We're just raw acting here. That's really what this is. You get the juicy part this time. You're going to start off, so I'm going to give you the action. Are you ready?
Let's do it.
And action.
I can't get a day's work done for all the good citizens coming in here to harass me about crime in the points. Some even go so far as to accuse us of connivance in this so-called rampant criminality. What am I to do? I can't have this. Something has to be done.
What do you have in mind?
I don't know. I think maybe we should hang someone.
Who?
No one important necessarily. Average men will do. Back alley amusers with no affiliations.
How many?
Three or four.
Which?
Four.
And scene. Apparently, I decided to play it as Clint Eastwood tonight.
Well, that works.
That's where I started out anyway. I don't know where I ended up, and that's the beauty of Massacre Theater. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, December 2nd, so with the Thanksgiving holiday, you got a little extra time to listen to the show and get that entry in.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
So what's it gonna be, Ruth?
I'm gonna stay here. And I'm gonna have that abortion like I wanted. 'Cause I'm a citizen, and I got my rights to, pick, and you're just trying to, and, I'm a woman, and my body belongs to me.
Laura Dern there as the title character Ruth in Alexander Payne's debut film, Citizen Ruth, a film that did not fare so well, spoiler alert, in this week's poll results, as we did ask you last week for your favorite Alexander Payne film. We were looking ahead to this week's discussion of Nebraska, and pretty simple. You had five choices. You'd made five films up to this point, and your choices were Citizen Ruth, Election, About Schmidt, Sideways, or more recently, The Descendants. Josh, how did it come out?
I can't remember the last time a choice only received 1% of the vote, but that is what went to Citizen Ruth. About Schmidt came next with 6% of the vote, followed by The Descendants with 23%, so up at the top. Sideways, 33% of the vote, meaning the win went to election with 37%.
And I think that's where we came out. You went sideways and I went election. Yep. So we were there with most of our listeners. Patrick Banks in Lee Summits, Missouri writes in, election is my pick because it did the one thing that most movies never do, genuinely surprised me at every turn. I still remember walking out of the theater with a big grin on my face, giddy to return for another viewing. Great film.
Rob in Chicago described election as a rare kind of magic. There's a lot of recognizable truth in Reese Witherspoon's portrayal of Tracy Flick's neediness and in the existential angst of the Matthew Broderick character. And it is the most exquisitely cast of Payne's films, and all of his films are exquisitely cast.
Isn't there that moment in election? I think it's my favorite line in the whole film where Matthew Broderick has something he has to be at a certain time. It's been a long time since I've seen election. And he says, how about 320 or something like that, which is, of course, something only a school teacher would say, you know, 320.
Yes.
So there are great little touches like that in election. But Joshua G closes us out. He says, best? My favorite is definitely election, but best, I'd say it's probably Sideways, which is probably the most interesting story of the group. Sideways has always felt like a deeper, darker, and funnier look at a midlife crisis I fear I may one day go through. Giamatti and Church are brilliant, and Madsen adds a great flavor to it. Good thing I don't like wine.
Yeah, now you know not what to do, Joshua, when that midlife
That's
crisis
right.
hits.
That's right. It's a cautionary tale, if you will. That brings us to this week's poll question. As we teased at the top of the segment, we're looking ahead to Old Boy, and this was the film that really did inspire our Korean auteurs marathon, as we wanted to go back and see some films from other Korean auteurs like Park Chan-wook, who, of course, made the original Old Boy, and now Spike Lee is remaking it. I did finally see the trailer, Josh, for the first time the other day for Old Boy.
You couldn't avoid it? Or?
No. You know, sometimes you get to the theater early. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
I'm not going to close my eyes, though I did with Before Midnight actually run out of the theater. But no, most often I just sit there and grin and bear it. I'm kind of glad I watched it because I have to admit now, I'm kind of more excited to see it.
Really?
Yeah.
Because you saw something different or new that's
not at all?
No,
actually, it seems really faithful to the original.
Oh, and that's a good thing for you.
Somehow
huh?
that attracts me.
Okay.
I don't know why. Maybe it's because I did like the original film. We want to know what attracts you, if anything, about Spike Lee's Old Boy coming out. Josh, the choices are?
The cast. And in addition to Charlton Copley, who we heard from earlier, this also has Josh Brolin, Elizabeth Olsen, and Samuel L. Jackson. So the cast is one option. The story itself. What about Spike Lee? Or are you just not interested?
So where are you at right now, Josh?
Oh, it's totally Spike for me.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're a Spike Lee guy.
Yeah.
Okay, so Spike Lee, for me, what interests me most, you know what? It's Spike Lee as well.
Cool.
Yeah, it is. I want to see what he's going to do with this material, so we want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net.
For probably the first time in our Korean auteurs marathon, Adam, and so far we've reviewed five recent films from acclaimed Korean filmmakers, the movie we sat down to watch was pretty much what we expected. Unlike The Chaser, say, or Secret Sunshine, there weren't really any genre tweaks or narrative U-turns here. The Netflix description pretty much says this: after their mother's death, two sisters must exorcise their home of dark forces. So A Tale of Two Sisters looked like a horror film, and that's exactly what it is. This isn't to say, though, that the movie, and it's based on a Korean folktale directed by Kim Ji-woon, is free of twists. As a matter of fact, A Tale of Two Sisters operates much like The Sixth Sense, or at least it did for me, worked up to a big reveal that explains all that we'd been left in the dark about for much of the film. Now, one reason we're not clear what's going on is because this is a story that's told by a handful of unreliable narrators, at least for its first half and probably a little bit past that. We have Soo Mi, played by Im Soo-jung. This is the older sister who's just back from a stay at a psychiatric hospital after the death of her mother. There's also Soo Yun, played by Moon Jeon-yeon, and that's the younger sister who is also at the hospital. Then we have their really maddeningly indifferent father, played by Kim Kap-soo, and lastly, their stepmother, played by Yeom Jeon-ha, who's clearly up to no good. We get that sense right from the start. So when weird things start happening, the murder of pet birds, odd noises at night,
women under the sink.
Yeah, that sort of thing too. It's conceivable that really any one of these characters could be the culprit. Was this uncertainty enough to carry you through the bulk of the movie? And when that twist came, was it worthy of comparison to The Sixth Sense? In other words, can it sustain and justify the whole film?
Well, I guess the short answer is no, it didn't for me, Josh, at all. In terms of a reveal, in terms of us getting some grand truth at the end of this film. I don't know. Maybe you can reveal it to me. I must have missed it. You're smarter than me, or at least more tuned into this film, and we're really buying into the mood of this movie, which I never really did. And I think you could actually argue that this movie has two big reveals. One of them I saw coming, mainly from seeing other similar movies. The Sixth Sense is one. I also thought a lot about the movie The Others. It made me think of that film right away. The other reveal, I still have no clue, honestly, Josh, what to make of it. I think I need someone to unravel it for me. And I guess that means then that no, those reveals didn't really work well enough. And I don't think the film offered much beyond it either, which isn't to say that there weren't things I appreciated about the film. But I guess for me, there's a fine line between being provocative and mysterious and being just obfuscating and annoying. Whatever this movie was going for, it just never connected with me, not emotionally, not intellectually, not psychologically. And in terms of expectations, I thought based on what I knew from the description and just seeing the artwork for the movie poster, which honestly, I kind of think is more provocative than the whole movie. I could study that poster with the family sitting there and the blood on their dresses. I could look at that for 2 hours and probably get more out of it than I did this film. I thought I would be scared at least once. And Josh, I honestly, and I'm, you know, the biggest scaredy cat in the world.
You're kind of a wimp.
I'm a total wimp. This movie never scared me, not even once, and it certainly was trying to. There are many, many instances of classic horror kind of cliches where you get that sharp burst of music as the camera pans and someone suddenly comes into a room or there's a mysterious figure all of a sudden hovering above one of the characters. Never worked for me. It reminded me a lot, actually, of a film from this year from another Korean director, Park Chan-wook's Stoker, for a lot of reasons, including their young female protagonist, but especially in how I think they do both rely largely on artifice and mood to sustain the narrative. And I didn't really go for Stoker either, but at least I didn't feel like Stoker was just teasing me along for 2 hours, which is how I felt with this film. What about you?
I thought you were going to say that it didn't need the surprise because it was offering so much elsewhere in the movie. You really didn't like this, huh?
No, it didn't really ever land.
I wasn't wild about it myself. I mean, I would recommend it to people. I think it's of interest. But I agree that it's pretty much all about the twists. And they're not at a Sixth Sense level where they make you rethink the whole film or lead you to just a deeper appreciation for what had come before. They're
or twists. Think about anything beyond the twist.
Right, exactly.
Beyond the film.
The point of this film, for me too, I agree, is the twist or the twists. There are two. You're right. Now, are you referring to the first one that was more confusing or the second one?
The second one.
Okay.
The first one I saw coming.
The first one, I knew something was coming. I didn't quite have exactly how it was going to break down. Or let me put it this way. I didn't quite know for sure whose perspective we were going to end up getting.
Agreed.
Once we understand that, okay, now I know whose story this is, and there's a degree of trust there. But what happens, and I think this is what frustrated you because I felt a little bit of that too, is all of the suspense disappears at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much from that point until the end of the film, and maybe it's 20 minutes, it might even be longer, we get all of these red herrings thrown at us, which would be fine if we were still in the dark a little bit. But because we know who's seen all this, we understand that these are red herrings. There's no dramatic import to any of them. I found myself just sitting back and waiting for the movie to come to an end. I mean, I didn't have any connection to any of the supposed developments that mm-hmm. happened in the final third of the film. Now, that being said, I did find it a little more interesting stylistically than you, although that is a great poster, up until that reveal. It's a very patient, very quiet, very hushed film. And I did like how the director let moments breathe. This house that the four of these people are in, one of the creepy things about it is that it's so quiet.
Yeah.
There are no other noises. Even though all four of them are there, they're often in separate rooms, just kind of sitting crouched, waiting for something horrible to happen.
And when someone's spoken to, they most often just don't respond at all.
Yes.
So there is a lot of silence.
Yeah, and I found that to be fairly effective in terms of tension building. I really respond to slow boil horror films more than other kinds. So I'd agree it wasn't ever terrifying, but it did hold my interest well enough. And then Kim Ji-woon, the director, does crank things a little bit when we get a clarification of that perspective. Suddenly the camera gets a little hectic and the style gets heightened. There's even some fast motion sequences, I think. And so I did like how we made that little twist, but again, narratively, there wasn't anything there to hold me.
Well, for me, I did like the fact that it often got by with being at least a little bit creepy in the daytime. which, you know, how often a horror movie, of course, it relies on that creepiness of nighttime and that uncertainty in the dark. And there's a lot of darkness in this film, too, just in the house. It's not very well lit. So that makes everything a little mysterious, too, as you have figures coming towards you. Even if you can see their whole bodies, you don't really know who it is in this movie. But again, seeing moments like that happen in daylight that I think were trying to be scary that never really did strike me as scary. Nevertheless, I like the fact that they were going for it. I also like the fact that it reminded me, Josh, how effective simple camera movement and perspective in particular, you mentioned it, point of view can be in horror movies. When the camera here just starts to wander a little bit, it starts on a certain character and then it kind of just wanders down a body or wanders to the right as if it's getting distracted by something else, or it cuts to an angle from a POV we haven't seen up to that point and weren't aware of before. It makes you feel like other forces are at work in this room. It's almost as if the director and the DP and the editor are all working together to be sort of the mysterious figure in the room watching these characters. And so that really did strike me stylistically. That's something I appreciated about the film. I also appreciated the commitment of all the performances. I don't think anybody's bad here at all. They're all quite effective.
Yeah, and I should add that one of the other possible culprits is a ghost. And so I think that point of view you're talking about might be a ghost. And yeah, we should point out two of the performances, particularly for me, I thought were quite good. And that is Im Soo-jung as the older sister. I mean, she's asked to do a lot in a lot of different ways here and makes every scene work pretty effectively. She's kind of who we connect to right at the beginning, even though it is a joint story, as I mentioned. And I also really thought that Yum Jung-ah as the stepmother was pretty interesting, because what starts as the evil stepmother, I mean, they really embrace that. Suddenly we get different viewpoints of that. And it's not necessarily that she's revealed to be something completely unlike what we expect, but she does get scenes where she's behaving quite differently. We don't know quite why she's doing it, yet Yum Jung-ha does sell the scene.
Yeah, she really does. I think for me, though, it does go back to that sense of obfuscation, like I said, where it's being willfully confusing as opposed to provocative and mysterious, as I noted. I think there's a key scene that displayed that for me, where we finally get a showdown between two characters that we've kind of been building up to. We know it's going to get there, and we're hoping, at least I was hoping, that we were going to get something really charged and interesting out of that confrontation between these two characters. And the character who is in control in that scene, at least according to the translation, if you're reading the subtitles, I'm pretty sure, Josh, I counted six straight lines of hers that were six straight questions. So imagine someone in a movie, you're watching them, you're waiting for some little bits of information to be revealed, or at least something for you to latch onto and carry you through this scene and maybe on through the rest of the film. And instead you get things like, what's brought us to this point? Do you remember what I said would happen? And then four more questions. She just keeps asking questions, never giving any hint of an answer. And I know you could say, well, it's trying to be mysterious and it's being subtle and it's more psychological and it's more important that the character she's talking to does know what she's talking about. But you know what? As an audience member, I felt like I was left out of that conversation and wasn't getting enough breadcrumbs to really walk me along the path to really be engaged by this movie.
Yeah. And for me, it's all treading water at that point. I mean, again, we know what the truth is, except for one little narrative reveal that we expect we're going to get about what happened to the family in the past. That we know is still coming. But in terms of whose story this has become, we know that truth. And I just sat there kind of waiting for the movie to end.
That is A Tale of Two Sisters, the final film in our Korean auteurs marathon. After a couple of weeks, we did finally get to close that out. Though, Josh, we haven't officially closed it out. As we do with all of our marathons, we are going to have our awards. We may save that, honestly, just for some bonus content, which is the bonus audio you get if you have the Film Spotting app for iPhone or Android phone or Windows 8 phone. You can get all the information about our apps at filmspotting.net, or you never know, we might work it into the show. We do need a good name for these awards. As always, we turn to you, our wizened listeners, to send us some great ideas, feedback@filmspotting.net, and then we're going to share our best picture, our best performances, our best moment of the marathon as well. I'm looking forward to that.
We're heading out for Parts Unknown when we come back to list the best movies with places in their title. Are you a fan of road trips, Adam?
Does it have some cool music to go along with a road trip?
I think I'm going to have to pick the music. Sorry.
All right.
Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
I haven't flown in my dreams since I was at least 11. So now I sleep when I fly, just to get even.
I drive with no lights on whenever there's a full moon. Full moon. I tend to sing along with the radio on when I don't know the tune. The tune. I got one hand on the wheel, one's holding my coffee, and I'm still holding the phone talking to you. I hope to remain so severely talented, at least for another mile or two.
Hey folks, want to jump in for another quick second here to thank all of our listeners who went to filmspotting.net and clicked on the donate page or went directly to PayPal and sent some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. And of course, we're only highlighting the new donors, but the fact is the lifeblood of the show is our $2 a month, $5 a month, and $10 donors who really have been sustaining us for several years now. But we will highlight a couple of those new names, Josh, including a new $5 a month donor.
That would be Jason from North Potomac, Maryland.
We also have a donation this week from Jennifer in Bowling Green, Ohio.
You're what makes the 45-minute commute the best part of my morning. Thank you for your humor, wisdom, and mutual passion for cinema I can't get anywhere else.
Wow. Very kind words from Jennifer. We do appreciate it. And we appreciate everybody who, again, not only donated or is a monthly donor, but who went over to iTunes and rated us. We had that Get to 1,000 ratings contest, and now we've blown that away, and we're over 1,100 now. We are going to try to get to 1,250. Let's see if we can get to 1,250 ratings.
We can do that.
I know we can easily do it. If you haven't done it already, it just takes a second to go to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating, or give us that rating and also leave a positive comment about the show. It really does make a difference, and thanks to everyone who has done it so far. Quick note about our music this week. Hal Gelb, you heard music from his new album, The Coincidentalists, The Three Deaths of Lucky, and Picacho Peak. Gelb is from Tucson, Arizona, maybe best known for his band Giant Sand, which has been making music since the mid-80s. He's currently on tour, playing a few dates this weekend in the Pacific Northwest before getting to Chicago on December 6th, where he'll play here at the Old Town School of Folk Music, and then it's off to the North and East Coast for shows in Toronto, New York, and Philly. If you like what you hear, more information is at howgelb.com.
I'm doing it now. In case he's looking down on me. When I was a child, my daddy taught me how to stare with my knee.
Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners, welcome to the new order. Are you ready for the next world? You better be, because on the new Film Spotting streaming video unit, Allison Wilmore and I review Kaboom from director Greg Araki.
Inspired by Kaboom, we'll also recommend some other titles about the end of the world available for instant streaming or rental. It's the end of the world as we know it, and we feel pretty okay about the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. To listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us in iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
Hi, this is Lynn Shelton, director of Hump Day and Your Sister Sister. You are listening to Film Spotting.
Inside of us, we both know you belong with Victor. You're part of his work, the thing that keeps him going. If that plane leaves the ground and you're not with him, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life.
But what about us?
We'll always have Paris.
You're listening to Film Spotting, of course, Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman will always have Paris, and Josh will always have Casablanca in the Film Spotting pantheon, which means it's not eligible for any top five, especially this week's top five. We are sharing our top five movies with places in their titles.
Nice job getting that out.
Yeah, that was awful. It's the worst title for a Film Spotting top five ever, and maybe our most arbitrary, which is why I struggled with it so much. Again, Casablanca's out. Chinatown also would qualify as being out for this list because it's in the Film Spotting pantheon. Josh, how did you go about forming a top five list out of truly one of the most ridiculous themes we've ever had?
Yeah, I mean, the only limitation I put is I just kept it to cities, states, or countries just to help me narrow it down. So Chinatown would not have been eligible, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Casablanca could have. Otherwise, it is completely arbitrary. It's just a good excuse to talk about some really good movies. And actually, most of them on my list, possibly all of them, have never been on a top five before. So.
I had a few of those as well.
Good.
I tried to go down that path. So let's hear what you got. What's your number five?
My number five is Young Girls of Rochefort. Jacques Demy's Umbrellas of Cherbourg is on my top 10 of all time list. So I had to go with something else. Couldn't pick that. Went with another musical of his that has a location in the title.
Sol, la, fa, sol, si, la, la, sol.
Yes, it's a sol minor.
Sol, la, fa, sol, la, mi, sol, fa, mi, fa, do, fa. I'm sorry, mademoiselle, mais je suis amoureux.
Vous avez de la chance.
Je fais ce que je peux. Ah, la, 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 la. Oh, la, la.
From 1967, and it's another nod to the classic Hollywood musical. Even has Gene Kelly in a supporting part here with a great tap number. It's set and filmed in the French title city and has an ensemble cast as this festival converges on the town. Among the main characters are a pair of sisters played by real-life sisters Catherine Deneuve and Françoise d'Orléac. They teach music and ballet to kids, but they long to move to Paris. And actually, Max Ophüls' muse Danielle Darrieux has a part as their mother. Now, the most enjoyable parts for me in this film was what was going on in the background. There's dancing and twirling of the extras in most of the scenes, even if the action is on main characters in the foreground who are just walking or talking. There's always something interesting going on. Otherwise, this is a decidedly French take on romance. Love isn't an achievable goal like it is in an American Hollywood romance where it's viewed as something we need to earn or attain. Instead, love is this elusive thing in this movie. Like those people in the background, it's just always in motion.
Great pick. For me, Josh, I did try to narrow this down to titles where that location that's in the movie's title is integral to the story. And it may sound obvious, of course it is, or they wouldn't name it after that, like Nebraska looms large in many ways over the film that inspired this week's top five, the latest from Alexander Payne. There were movies, though, where that location wasn't just something that, like Fargo, for example, in Raising Arizona, it's more of a symbolic thing. Nothing ever actually happens in Fargo, as far as I can recall from that movie. But I wanted to find places where you couldn't separate the location from the narrative. I mentioned a couple of films that are in our pantheon, so ineligible. Some movies I tucked away into my personal penalty box just for this list because I do think they've gotten enough love here over the years on the show. Woody Allen's Manhattan, Harlan County, USA, which was on a recent top five, Fargo from the Coen brothers, Raising Arizona from the Coen brothers, and also My Winnipeg, the film from Guy Madden that I really do like quite a lot. It's come up a few times over the years, including during my interview with Guy Madden back at the Toronto International Film Festival. So all those movies ineligible. What movies did make my list? Well, this one is a bit of a film spotting favorite as well. As a character at the end of the film muses, because at least in prison and at least in death, you know, I wouldn't be in effing Bruges. In Bruges is my number five pick. It's the 2008 black comedy that was the debut of Martin McDonagh, the playwright turned writer and director. It stars Colin Farrell, the guy behind those lines, and Brendan Gleeson. They're two hitmen who are in hiding after a job gone wrong, and they're sent to Bruges, and it really is a purgatory. But if you think about it, there are quite a few movies that involve purgatory-like places for the main characters, and usually they're much more desolate. You would never describe them really as beautiful. They feel like what you would think of when you think of hell on earth. They're definitely not touristy at all. But of course, as you see it in the film, and it was shot on location in Bruges in Belgium, it's beautiful. It's full of this medieval architecture. It's got lots of religious symbolism, which is crucial to the story, and McDonagh, too, as a writer. But there's just something, I think, Josh, so perfect about being trapped in a place so gorgeous. And it emphasizes the split between our main characters as well. You've got that divide, the man of culture, Ken, Brendan Gleeson, and the guy looking just for a good time and a nice date and maybe some good drugs. That's Colin Farrell's Ray.
What's up there? The view.
The view of what? If you go down here, I can see that from down here.
Ray, you're about the worst tourist in the whole world.
Ken, I grew up in Dublin. I love Dublin. If I'd grown up on a farm and was retarded, Bruges might impress me. But I didn't, so it doesn't.
I love that in doing a little bit of research about Bruges, it's often referred to, or some people call it, the, quote, Venice of the North. which sounds really good. But when you think about that, when a location has a nickname like that, all it does is draw attention to the fact that it's not Venice.
It's not quite up to snuff.
Right, exactly. It's the poor man's Venice. It just doesn't have that stature, and it's trying to build it up with a phrase like that, but it really tells you more what it isn't. And maybe he could have found other locations out there that could have matched everything I've just described about Bruges, but it's also just so fun to say. And for Martin McDonagh as a writer, as a playwright, that's obviously really important to have a location like Bruges that these characters can constantly go back to and say.
Good pick. That was an honorable mention for me. My number four, it wouldn't have met your criteria, Adam, of the place having to be reflected in the movie itself, because it's Terry Gilliam's Brazil, his futuristic slapstick satire with Jonathan Pryce as a government worker bee who gets involved in a terrorist conspiracy. It's messy, it's spastic, like a lot of Gilliam's films tend to be, but that's usually okay with me. I'm even a fan of Jabberwocky, his film based on the nonsense poem from Lewis Carroll, so I have a high tolerance for this sort of stuff from Gilliam. I haven't seen Brazil in a while, so I'm going to quote Dave Kerr's 1985 review of the film that comes from the Chicago Reader. He says, Terry Gilliam's ferociously creative black comedy is filled with wild tonal contrasts, swarming details, and unfettered visual invention. Every shot carries a charge of surprise and delight. That's pretty much how I remember it, so Brazil's my number four.
That's a movie I badly need to revisit, because I've been on record over the years as saying I find it a little bit overrated, but I've only seen it once, and it just didn't really connect with me the way other Gilliam films did, so maybe my expectations were a little bit too high. I'm sure that Dave Kerr somewhere, Josh, has waxed very eloquently about my number four pick, which is the 1984 comedy directed by Martin Brest, Beverly Hills Cop.
That might be tough to find.
Eddie Murphy, of course. This is one of those movies for me, Josh, that's never made a top five. And some listeners, maybe even you, Josh, at least those listeners who weren't children of the 80s like we were, they may feel like that's probably a good thing and makes total sense that it's never come up before. But you know what? I've caught Beverly Hills Cop a few times in recent years on HBO or on cable or something. And honestly, every time it comes on, I find myself getting sucked into it and watching it until the very end. And I think it holds up. And I think it's a great reminder of just how talented and charismatic Eddie Murphy was on the big screen at his peak. And this is pretty early in his career. It's after 48 Hours, 2 years after that film, which was his breakout role. But this is the role that really made him a movie star as Axel Foley. He's really hilariously funny in scene after scene, of course, doing many voices and doing characters, but it's always grounded. You always do believe Eddie Murphy as a Detroit cop. He's serious when he needs to be serious. And where else do you put a tough African-American detective from the mean streets of Detroit to be a fish out of water than Beverly Hills, these high-priced art salons and the fancy hotels and the people walking around with their poodles and all the swimming pools? Everybody in the film underestimates him. They all assume he's one way. He's one type of person because of his skin color, often because of his appearance. And there's a great scene early in the movie where he's just been arrested for being thrown out of a window. And he's at the Beverly Hills police station, and he gets into this little sparring match with Taggart. Both guys get in each other's faces, and Taggart ends up punching him in the stomach. And Taggart gets called in by his lieutenant, who makes Taggart apologize and ask Axel if he wants to press charges.
This is some kind of joke, right? Do you wish to file charges against this officer for assault? Look, where I'm from, cops don't file charges against other cops. No, I don't want to do that.
And I just love Eddie Murphy's reaction to that, how he plays it. He's in shock, clearly, but he tries to play it cool. He actually crosses his leg a little bit. Like, sure, this happens all the time where I'm from. Two guys will get up in each other's faces and then just calmly resolve it that way and accept the apology. So that's just one of those scenes that I think really does indicate that divide between where he comes from and the place in the name of the movie, Beverly Hills Cop. I love it.
I'm not going to scoff at Beverly Hills Cop. It's probably been since maybe junior high since I've seen it, but I have a feeling I'd think that it holds up too. For my number three, I'm going to go back to 1940 with The Thief of Baghdad. This is drawn from The Arabian Nights and based on the 1924 Douglas Fairbanks swashbuckler of the same name. But what I like about this version is how it works as a special effects artifact. It's 1 year older than The Wizard of Oz, and it employs some of the same old-fashioned studio magic. The lavish producer here was Alex Korda. some of the nice touches, there's this combination of soundstage sets and matte paintings so that you have the city of Baghdad that's made of these endless blue buildings. They just go on and on and on. And there's also an early version of blue and green screen technology that enables horses and carpets to fly. But, you know, if you look closely, you'll catch this blue glow around the images that somehow these days is kind of endearing. You even get a giant genie who shares the screen with a normal-sized hero, Abu.
Ago, King Solomon, master of all the jinn, imprisoned me within that bottle. For me, this is the first moment of my new freedom. For you, this is the last moment of your life.
Certainly doesn't hold up to today's special effects standards, but they do have their own enchanting quality. It's a similar experience to watching a silent Méliès film in some way. It's like watching someone pull a rabbit out of the hat for the first time.
The Thief of Baghdad is one I need to, sadly, catch up with. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're sharing our top five movies with places in their titles. It is inspired by this week's review of the new Alexander Payne movie, Nebraska. And my number three, Josh, is another movie, like Beverly Hills Cop, that's never made a top five list before. But this one, I would say, probably more shocking to most listeners. It's also a movie that I've been on record as having taken forever to finally break down and watch. But I did do that about 4 years ago. And even though I didn't love it as much as many cinephiles I know, it's still a really damn good movie. Good enough for this top five, certainly at the number three slot. And that's Lawrence of Arabia. The David Lean epic from 1962, of course, stars Peter O'Toole as T.E. Lawrence, and it does chronicle his experiences in Arabia during World War I. I was watching some clips online today of some famous filmmakers, guys like Scorsese and Spielberg, talking about Lawrence of Arabia and why they love it so much, and Spielberg calls it a miracle. He praises Lean for telling small stories, for giving us a real intimate portrait of a man, but against, of course, this epic backdrop. And I think he's dead on. It really is the miracle of this movie. But that location, the desert, how it's shot, Lawrence's affiliation and his affection for the Arabian tribes, and then that conflict that develops between that allegiance to those tribes and that exotic location and his ties to his native British army, that's really what plays out in Lawrence of Arabia. And I think makes it, beyond just the spectacle of it, such a special movie.
I want to say the only time I've seen that, it might have been the Music Box here in Chicago, but I think it was actually the McClurg Court Theater, which is now torn down, but used to have this huge 70mm screen. I think I saw it there. My number two is not a movie that requires a big screen at all. It's South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut.
Nice.
Top 10 lister for me from 1999. Trey Parker and Matt Stone took their Comedy Central barely animated series to the big screen in what was this rude, hilarious, crude, epic, also something of a self-critique, I thought. And this was one of those cultural seasons when everyone was talking about how Hollywood was corrupting our children. We go through these every once in a while. And the plot here does involve the South Park grade schoolers who sneak into this filthy theatrical cartoon from Canada. They come out acting like Bart Simpson gone bad, and it incites this war between the U.S. and Canada. So underneath the satire about how paranoid parents can be is a clever little admission that, yes, kids can also be influenced by popular culture.
The machinery of the V-chip is very simple. It is placed under the child's skin, where it emits a small shock of electricity whenever an obscenity is uttered.
Now, wait a minute. This chip somehow knows if the child is swearing?
It's just like a lie detector, you see. Certain things happen to you when you swear, just like when you lie. The chip picks up on this and gives the subject a little prick. Patient B5, would you step out here, please? Patient B5 here has been fitted with the new V-chip.
Ah, oh, my head hurts.
Don't worry about that. Now, I want you to say, doggy.
Doggy.
Notice that nothing happens. Now say, Montana.
Montana.
Good. Now, pillow.
Pillow.
All right. Now I want you to say, horse.
Go ahead, Eric. It's all right.
Horse.
It's been way too long since we've had a Trey Parker, Matt Stone feature. Team America World Police, which also made my top 10 list in 2004. That's their last one. So I'm really hoping that that rumored Book of Mormon feature is in the works.
Yeah, I was going to say they've only since that time been redefining Broadway as we know it with the Book of Mormon. Otherwise, not doing anything, those guys. Great pick. My number two, going to go a little more art house from South Park there. I have to make up for Beverly Hills Cop somewhere, Josh, is the 1959 Alain René film Hiroshima Mon Amour. And we talked about the film Amour, the Michael Haneke film from last year, and the amazing performance from the star of that movie, Emmanuelle Riva, the French actress. Well, of course, you can go back and see her really in her prime in 1959 as the French actress, one of the leads, one of two leads in this movie, who is making a movie in Hiroshima, and she has an affair with a Japanese architect who we learned was a soldier during World War II and had his family in Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, of course, when the atomic bomb was dropped. We come to learn through their conversations, and that's what really this movie is kind of just an extended conversation, their memories, their arguments, their notions of memory that come up over and over again. We learn that she has her own haunted past from the war as well. It's definitely experimental in form, or at least highly nonlinear. I think it's only made one top five list in the history of this show, and that was my top five nonlinear movies. But there are just certain places and locations, and Hiroshima is definitely one of them, that are forever going to be inseparable from an event that occurred there. And it's hard to find something more tragic and sweeping in its scope than the bombing of Hiroshima. Even if places somehow do eventually get rebuilt and move on, the question I think this movie poses, among the many questions it poses, and I think it poses a lot more interesting questions than answers, is can the people, can such horrors from our past ever be really moved on from, or will they haunt you forever as they do seem to haunt this couple? And I think it also provocatively asks you, how does love happen, or how do two people really connect in a world and in a place where that type of horror occurred? It's a really beautiful black and white movie. It's based on the Marguerite Duras short story. And Alain René, as I was writing my notes about this pick earlier today, Josh, occurs to me, I think should probably be a marathon candidate at some point, because he's still making films. I think he's in his 80s. He still has movies coming out every couple of years. And this movie and Night and Fog, sadly, might be my only Alain René film. So
let's add him to the
list. We need to get on that.
All right, you made up for Beverly Hills Cop. I'll try to make up for South Park. I'm going from the subversiveness there to the squareness of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington with Frank Capra and Jimmy Stewart.
Here you are, Senator. Not a bad desk either. Daniel Webster used to use it.
Daniel Webster sat here?
Give you something to shoot at, Senator, if you figure on doing any talking.
Oh, no, I'm just going to sit around and listen.
And that's a way to get reelected. This is the counter for the day.
Capra, though, he makes corniness work, especially when he is teamed up with Stewart, who just has this impeccable sincerity about him. This is from the great movie year of 1939, with Stewart as Jefferson Smith, the novice senator who's picked by a corrupt political machine that expects him to just vote as he's told. Of course, he soon starts thinking for himself, to the horror of all these career politicians around him. Great cast in this picture has Thomas Mitchell as the Seen It All reporter, Claude Rains as Smith's conflicted mentor, and Jean Arthur as his politically savvy secretary. Also has Smith's famous filibuster on the Senate floor, a little bit more entertaining than Ted Cruz's. It makes you not only believe in democracy, but you actually want to believe in it. And that's a distinction that, you know, few inspirational movies can take us to. So Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, my number one.
A really good pick, though. You did mention corniness, and Sean Gilman, one of our FAB members, the Film Spotting Advisory Board, I call him the dean of the Film Spotting Forum, he's out there right now drafting you a large post in the forum, taking you to task, I'm sure, for saying that, because he really defends this movie as something beyond just that Capricorn and argues that the ending is really much more cynical. And he may be onto something.
But, oh, there's a thread of cynicism in the film, for sure. Yeah.
Well, my number one, I think, Josh, if it taught us anything, it's that if you're going through some rough country, you better have some beans. I know that's what you tell your family whenever you guys go out hiking. I think it's a great counter to the aesthetic of my number two pick, Hiroshima Mon Amour. And the movie is The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Paul Thomas Anderson, in an article on the Directors Guild of America website, breaks down the movie. And I'll link to it in the show notes. But he sat with the writer and just watched the movie and talked about it, because it's a movie he watched several times to prepare himself for a lot of reasons for the movie There Will Be Blood. And I encourage you to read it. He analyzes that movie infinitely better than I can. He's certainly seen the movie more than I have. But for those maybe not familiar, the story, basically, it's set back in Mexico in 1925, and you've got John Huston, the director's father, Walter Huston, there in the movie. He hooks up with Humphrey Bogart and Tim Holt as two Americans, and they go on this gold expedition through some pretty dangerous terrain. And about the movie, Paul Thomas Anderson says this: I was trying to find something that was 100% straightforward, old-fashioned storytelling. I definitely tried to mimic that approach. My natural instincts as a writer may be more scattered, so in an effort to be more traditional, I used a book just like they did. He's talking about There Will Be Blood. Sierra Madre is as direct as you can get. Nothing clever, nothing structurally new or different, and I mean that as a high compliment. It's harder than anything else to be completely straightforward. And I think he's dead on about the movie. At the same time, you can break it down frame by frame, just like P.T. Anderson does, and see the artistry, see the reasoning behind every single frame in the movie. And those mountains, the Sierra Madre, you see them in this movie. You see that terrain, the insanity it takes to plot a mission, the desperation of these characters. I think that's what those mountains represent. And you see how the greed and paranoia of these characters mixes with that desperation and the unforgivingness of those locations to ultimately take a tragic toll on those characters.
As long as I'm here and can do anything about it, you won't touch a single grain of the old man's goods.
I know exactly what you mean. You want to take it all for yourself and cut me out?
No, Dobbs. I'm on the level with the old man, just as I'd be on the level with you if you weren't here.
Get off your soapbox, will you? You only sound foolish out here in this wilderness. I know you for what you are. For a long time, I've had my suspicions about you. Now I know I've been right.
What suspicions are you talking about?
Oh, you're not putting anything over on me. I see right through you. For a long time, you've had it in your mind to bump me off at the first good opportunity and bury me out here in the bush like a dog, so you could take not only the old man's goods, but mine in the bargain. And when you get to Durango safely, you'll have a big laugh, won't you? Thinking how dumb the old man and I were. If you make another move toward me, and I'll pull the trigger. All right, get your hands up. Come on, get them up!
The Treasure of the Sierra Madre is my number one movie with a place in its title.
Nice job.
Thank you. I finally was able to spit that out there pretty easily. Josh, what about any honorable mentions for you?
Well, I do have to mention Cedar Rapids. It was the second best film of 2011. Couldn't quite beat out Tree of Life.
Says only you.
That's all right. Manhattan Raising Arizona, you brought up earlier. Those were honorable mentions as well. And I thought about Nashville, Good Morning Vietnam, and Last Tango in Paris.
Okay, all good. All movies I considered, except Cedar Rapids, though. I also did give that movie a positive review. The only one I'm going to mention that you didn't say, because there are so many. I mean, let's be honest. Yeah. There are a lot of good movies that have locations in their titles. For me, My Own Private Idaho, that's a movie I'm a big fan of. The Gus Van Sant film starring River Phoenix and Keanu Reeves. But just missed the cut. We want to know what made your cut. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You could also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. Or find us on Twitter at Filmspotting and at Facebook.com/Filmspotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, Delivery Man, this is an affable underachiever, guess who? Vince Vaughn, of course, learns that he's the biological father of 533 kids.
You know, I like Vince Vaughn, but why do his movies always sound so horrible?
Yeah, I know. He's kind of becoming a little bit like the Adam Sandler character in Funny People. You know, with those titles that just go, yep, that's a Vince Vaughn movie. You hear the little description there in the high concept. Also out in wide release, Hunger Games: Catching Fire, cue Josh convincing me that it has to be discussed on the show.
I will still let you on the Hunger Games bandwagon if you want to be on it. It's really good,
you know,
as the first one was. There's still time.
I'm good here.
You sure?
I've got my own wheels. I don't need to jump on board. I did see your Letterboxd review, so we may have an interesting conversation about that film at some point down the road. Out in limited release, American Promise, A Touch of Sin, and the Alexander Payne film Nebraska, which we discussed earlier. Next week, it is Thanksgiving, so we are taking a little bit of a break. There's no new show, but we're going to use that week to take a look back at the year in film with our Golden Brick preview. This is something we did last year as well at this time. Basically, we'll share our short list for the 2013 Golden Brick Award, which we give to a film that fits an elaborate set of criteria that we still really haven't defined and is constantly in flux.
We're just always throwing back what it could be, what it couldn't be.
Exactly, but really, at its core, movies we consider overlooked or underseen, they're often from a new-ish filmmaker or new to us, and we think they're inventively made. So that's the basic criteria.
At least past winners all exhibit some of those qualities.
Exactly. So we'll also revisit our full reviews of three of those Golden Brick candidates.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music this week comes from Hal Gelb. You can find more information at howgelb.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.